And speaking of books, here's a setting you just might recognize.
It was the December of 1970, and they were sitting in the senior common room of Hawley's College after dinner. It was cold, and the dinner had been meager and dull, culminating in some sort of nut pudding that closely resembled wet cement. The small fire in the room had just enough energy to warm the rug directly in front of it, and left the corners of the room to fend for themselves.
That's an excerpt from British writer Philip Pullman's brand new audiobook, The Collectors, which is set in a world familiar to many Pullman fans, the strange alternate Oxford of his award-winning fantasy trilogy, His Dark Materials. In Pullman's imagined world, characters travel through parallel universes. Animals talk, and everyone has a demon that follows them around. Steve Paulson loves these books, partly because there's a subtext about science and religion that runs through them, and partly because the heroine, a young girl named Lyra, is unforgettable. Pullman says Lyra's world is a lot like ours, but with a few key differences.
The first difference we encounter in the first four words of the book. The first word is Lyra, which is her name, and the next three words are and her demon. Lyra and her demon. And what they're doing is they're setting off to go to a place where they shouldn't be. Now, what's this demon? This was the question I found myself asking as soon as I wrote those words, because I began to write the story not knowing that Lyra had a demon, nor did any of the other characters in the story.
And when
I should explain that to the listeners that demon is spelt differently. It has an A in it, D-A-E-M-O-N. So it doesn't look like the word that means devil. It's a different sort of demon. And we quickly find out through the way they behave that Lyra's demon, whose name is Pantalaimon, is part of her. It's part of her personality. He has the form of an animal, and everyone in Lyra's world has a demon which is the form of an animal, and they take it for granted. You know, you see someone, you see their demon beside them. And it's part of their personality, and when you're a child, your demon can change shape. This is the big thing about the world. One moment it could be a snake or a bat or a rat or a mouse or whatever. In adolescence, this power to change gradually fades away, and the animal settles down in one fixed form which it'll have for the rest of its life and your life, because your demon dies when you do.
And the form that it takes is a reflection of the person's personality.
Yes, it's a sort of visible expression of their nature, if you like. This doesn't condemn them to any particular form of life or whatever. If your demon is a snake, for example, it doesn't mean that you will be a wicked person. It just means that your nature is serpentine, subtle, and so on. Now, you could turn that to good ends or bad ends. It entirely depends on another faculty that you have, which is known as your conscience, and of course, which is hidden away inside. But that's what your demon is. So this metaphor, you see, of the demon allowed me to say an awful lot about the way we are and the way people grow up and so on. I think we've all met people who aren't satisfied with the shape of their demon and would like to be something other than they are.
So really what you're doing, I mean, you're dealing with a lot of issues in these books, but part of it is the nature of childhood and what happens as we grow up.
Yes, this is the very heart of the book, the very center of the concern that I had while I was writing it, the nature of the difference between childhood and adulthood. Traditionally, and this is my quarrel with a lot of traditional children's literature, this has been seen as a fall, rather like the fall in the Garden of Eden, a decline from a state of paradisal innocence and charm and grace and so on into the sordidness of sex and the misery of paying the electricity bill and all this sort of stuff that we have to do when we're grown up. Well, I don't see it like that, and my book is taking a different line. The way I see it is that the loss, and it is a loss, of the innocence and the grace that we're born with is something that's a necessary stage that we all have to go through. That far from lamenting it, we should welcome it, we should accept it as a necessary stage, and we should then grow on to the next part of our development, because human beings in their middle part of their lives, as we are on a sort of spectrum, on a sort of ladder, or if you like, or a spectrum that leads from the innocence of childhood, if we are lucky, to, at the other end, wisdom. Now, this is something that has to be fought for and has to be striven for and has to be worked for and in a painstaking way has to be acquired. But the point is that innocence, we have to leave it. We have to leave it behind. Innocence cannot be wise.
And you're saying
and
that...
And furthermore, wisdom cannot be innocent.
And you're saying that a lot of traditional, of classic children's literature dodges this issue. Are you thinking about, I don't know, C.S. Lewis, Chronicles of Narnia?
C.S. Lewis is a very good case in point, because in the Chronicles of Narnia, he turns away in horror, explicitly with horror, from the process of growing up. At the very end of the final book in the series, The Last Battle, some listeners, if they've read the book, they might remember the extraordinary passage where one of the characters, Susan, the girl who's the sister of the other characters, is excluded from the stable, which stands for salvation, which stands for heaven, on the grounds that she always was too interested in growing up, says one of the characters. She's interested in nothing nowadays but lipstick and nylons. Now, this has always filled me with amazement that a children's writer can get away with this sort of thing. What he's saying is that growing up is something we must avoid at all costs. That when you grow up, you fall into the clutches of, well, lipstick and nylons, which means sexuality, which means Satan, which means let's avoid it. And his way of avoiding it at the very end of the last battle, the last book in this so highly praised work, he solves the problem by killing the children. He doesn't let them grow up. He kills them in a train accident and they all go to heaven. Now, this is bizarre. This is quite extraordinary stuff.
So you don't like these books at all?
I detest them. I think they're poisonous.
Well, we should talk a little bit about the story in your trilogy, His Dark Materials, because you've done something very daring, and I'm guessing you've gotten a fair amount of flack for it. The great villain in these stories is the church, is organized religion. This is the powerful force in the world that is trying to prevent these children from growing up, just trying to prevent Lyra, the heroine, from growing up.
Yes, that's the way I've got the story going. The church in Lyra's world has taken a different course. I should explain about these different worlds, first of all, in order to make this clear.
Sure.
The notion is that there are an infinite number of parallel worlds, some very similar to ours, but some very different. This apparently has some sort of scientific validity, this idea, though I've never been able to follow the mathematics of it.
I have talked with quantum physicists who have made this case.
Right. Well, so this is a wonderful gift for a storyteller, because then you can invent worlds that are however you like them to be, and then all you have to do is invent a gadget to get from one to the other, which is the subtle knife. Anyway, back to your question. In Lyra's world, the church has taken a very different course, and instead of having a sort of monolithic Catholic structure as we've had in Western Europe in our world, I posit the idea that the church has been split into a number of different conflicting and struggling and warring councils and colleges and so on and so forth. It's a sort of very uneasy United Nations of a church, I suppose you could say. But behind it all is the notion that knowledge is dangerous, that sin consists largely of curiosity, or curiosity is largely the embodiment of sin, and they must crush this. They must push it out of existence, which is what they're trying to do.
Although I think if you were to talk to most churchgoers, I mean, they wouldn't describe sin as curiosity. I mean, they would describe sin as evil deeds, murder, lying, thievery, jealousy, those kinds of things.
Yes, but the initial root of all these things, if you remember, was the sin of Eve, which was curiosity. The serpent said, "Taste this and you'll see what good and evil are like." So she did. And those things all came out of her initial sin of curiosity. That's where it all began, and that's what the Western Church has been saying for a long time. Not, I hasten to add, other religions, and not specifically, for example, the Eastern Orthodox churches, which have a very different view of original sin. So there are some parts of this of our world that do correspond quite closely with what goes on in the book. And you have only to look at the history of the Western churches to see the burning of heretics, the hanging of witches, the persecution of scientists, and so on. Every advance in science, just to take one example, has been torn from between the teeth of the church because the church resisted it tooth and nail.
So you're saying that if Eve had never taken a bite from the apple, if she had never developed that self-consciousness, that knowingness between good and evil, then we would be nothing today. I mean, we would be living in some state of innocence that would be totally dull.
That's the clear implication of the story. We would still be pets. We would still be children.
You enjoy taking shots at traditional Christian thinking, don't you?
Well, not just it's not that I enjoy taking shots at it. There's a great deal in traditional Christian thinking which I profoundly agree with. What Jesus says in the Gospels, for example, should be considered and followed by everyone, it seems to me. The problem is that when people get hold of the sayings of any great religious teacher, they soon develop a sort of, well, power structures develop, internal politics develop, leaderships and hierarchies develop, and then you get the situation where the church or the organization is more concerned with extending its own power and maintaining its own influence and so on than it is with transmitting the original teacher, which is what you see happening all over the place.
Philip Pullman talking with Steve Paulson. Pullman's the author of the award-winning fantasy trilogy called His Dark Materials, and he's just released a brand new audiobook following some of the same characters. It's called The Collectors.